We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So, get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.
We're here with the next episode of our Palisades podcast with a special guest, Bill Simon, and I'm Steve Crone.
And I'm Brooke Dougherty.
So before we start, let me give you just a few bullet points about Bill Simon. I'm sure most of you know who he is, but let me just tell you a couple things about him. He is the co-chairman of the William E. Simon & Sons Limited Liability Corporation, which is an investment company with real estate, private equity, and fixed income securities. He is a graduate of Boston College School of Law and Williams College as an undergraduate. He serves as co-chairman of the William E. Simon Foundation and the Cynthia L. and William E. Simon Jr. Foundations, helping needy youngsters in urban areas. He is the founder and chairman of the board for Parish Catalyst, as well as the Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center Board of Advisors. He's an adjunct assistant professor at UCLA School of Law and in the UCLA undergraduate economics department. He was the 2002 Republican gubernatorial nominee in California. He came up just a little bit short. And he also served as chairman of the California and director of policy and speechwriting for the Rudy Giuliani 2008 Presidential Campaign Committee. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Steve.
That's just a little snippet. Now we'd like to get it, put a little meat on those bones. So, Bill, I understand that you grew up on the East Coast, right?
I did. I grew up in New Jersey. I was born on the New Jersey shore. In Asbury Park, same place as the boss.
The boss. Did you follow the boss back then?
He's a little younger than me.
You can still
follow him. I sure followed him when he started making records.
Yeah. Yeah. Many of
and
us
actually,
did.
I sat next to him one time at Boston College. You mentioned Boston College Law School. Our youngest daughter, Lulu, attended Boston College. And Bruce Springsteen's son was in the same class as our daughter. And so at the first event, you know, kind of welcome to the parents, I sat next to Bruce Springsteen and his wife, Patty.
Wow. No offense, but I bet he got a little more attention than you did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People were like pushing me aside to get to the boss.
Well, I would too. I would have pushed you aside so quickly to get to the boss.
It's the same with my wife and I. They push me aside to get to my wife, Cindy.
I can imagine. She's probably much better looking than you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so you grew up in New Jersey, and I know just a little bit about your family, but I would remiss if we didn't ask about your dad.
Oh, sure. Well, Dad and my mom grew up on the Jersey Shore, right near Asbury Park in neighboring towns. And so when they were first married, they were very young. My mother was 19. My dad was like 22. I came along 9 months and probably 10 days after that. And I was the first of eight children.
Wow.
You know, we grew up, you know, I would say humble circumstances, honestly. And Dad, in the beginning, was changing truck tires for his father-in-law, and which was not a good experience for Dad, because Dad said that his father-in-law had always told his mother, don't marry Bill Simon, he'll never make anything of himself, which my father reminded him when he did make something of himself.
And he sure did.
And he sure did.
How did he go from changing truck tires to becoming the
Secretary of Treasury.
Secretary of the Treasury.
Well,
it's
an amazing story, really.
We got time.
And so he, when he was probably 23 or 24, he was changing truck tires down the Jersey Shore. And he ran into a guy at a party that had been an old boyfriend of my mother's. And this guy, whose name's Chris Devine, actually, had a lot to drink. Sorry, Chris. And so he started bragging about what he was doing on Wall Street, which my father had never heard of. And but Dad knew he was unhappy working for his father-in-law. So he said, geez, if you ever need any help, let me know. And Chris said, come to my office on Monday morning, and I'll put you to work. And he went on Monday morning, and Chris, having had quite a bit to drink on Saturday evening, forgot that he met Dad. But Dad didn't forget. And he kept showing up at Chris's office Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Chris finally said, okay, Bill, go to work down there at the end of that trading desk. And 4 years later, he was running that trading desk.
Wow. And he wasn't educated. He hadn't gone to college.
Well, he went to college, but barely. He flunked out of 3 high schools, and he went in the Army out of high school because he couldn't get into college. He barely got in. He got married as a sophomore. I came along when he was a junior. So he liked to say that he learned in the school of hard knocks.
What was it that, looking back on it, that when you look at your dad that you can point to say, here's a guy that was changing tires. 4 years later, he's running a trading desk on Wall Street. Was it brains? Was it ambition? Was it determination?
I think it was all those things. You know, I think he realized at a certain point, he used to tell me, that nobody was going to help him. You know, his father was not a good businessman, and, you know, he didn't have any ability to make a phone call for Dad. And so he made it on his own.
Wow.
He said, I'm going to have to do whatever it is I can do. And so at a very, you know, young age, you know, he was very self-sufficient, and he was smart. He used to say he was not book smart like you might be in school. He was street smart. So when he would run into people over the years that were book smart, but they didn't have common sense, he would say, those are 180 IQ idiots.
And he proved himself right.
He did.
So he starts running a trading desk and obviously was rising to the top.
He did. He did.
What company was that?
The name of that company was Whedon & Company. It's no longer in existence, but he was there in the 50s. And then he had an opportunity to go to work for a company called Salomon Brothers, which was a very well-known investment firm in that day. Subsequently, many years later, was acquired by Citibank, and it's no longer in existence. But in the old days, Salomon, you know, like Drexel, many years later, was a very famous bond fixed income firm. And Dad became the head trader of municipal securities and government securities.
And became obviously very important for Salomon Brothers.
Became very important. He was probably the number three person in the firm. It was Billy Salomon, John Goodfriend, and Bill Simon.
And did he stay with Salomon Brothers for most of his career?
He was at Salomon for about 10 years, and he had an opportunity to go in the federal government in the Treasury Department, and he took it.
Under which president?
Richard Nixon.
And he was appointed to a position by Nixon?
He was. He was appointed to the position of Deputy Secretary of the Treasury.
And then at some point he became the actual Secretary of the Treasury, right?
Exactly. When the Secretary resigned, George Shultz, he recommended that Dad be appointed Secretary of Treasury, and President Nixon agreed, and then he appointed him.
How long did he serve?
He served for 4 years.
And so growing up, was politics a part of your family life?
Not really, because by that point, by the time that Dad was appointed Secretary of Treasury, I was already out of college. I was working in New York City. Now, interestingly enough, as I mentioned, I come from a big family. I have 6 siblings. 1 passed away. So originally there were 8 children. Now there's 7. The last 2 or 3 kids grew up in an environment where Dad was well known. my brother and me and my two older sisters, we grew up in an environment where Dad said, you know, he wasn't well known and he was very careful about money. We thought there was no money. And one time, I remember when I was a senior in college, I came back to the to our house, and my roommates sat me down and said, "We know how much your money your dad made last year." I said, "Wow, that's more than I know." And they said he made $3 million, and it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And I went, "Wow, I had no idea." So I called my father. I thought he would be proud that I was reading the Wall Street Journal, which actually isn't true. I wasn't reading it. My roommates, you know, showed it to me. And I said, "Hey, Dad, I saw you in the Wall Street Journal." He goes, "Billy, shh, I'm in a lot of hot water around here. When I got home tonight, your mother sat me down on the bed and said, 'Bill, you never told me how much money you made.'" And the very next day, she went out and bought a new dress.
So I take it money and affluence wasn't a big part of your growing up.
No.
You didn't know you had it.
Nope, didn't. You know, I worked every summer. I played two sports in college. I was captain of two sports in college, All-American and one. I did my own thing. I mean, I love Dad and Mom.
Sure.
But when you grow up in a family with a lot of kids, at least in our family, there was only one rule. Dinner was at 6. My mother didn't ask me where I was because she was busy with the ones that were younger that really couldn't look out for themselves.
And did having essentially the same name as your dad, was that a positive thing or a negative thing in your life? Or
mostly positive. You know, occasionally negative, but mostly positive. Once Dad became well known, he publicly made a lot of money. Occasionally I could feel resentment from people, you know, that they figured I got to wherever I got to, you know, based purely on Dad's name. And, occasionally I would joke about it. Like when I ran for governor in 2002, for, you know, the first 6 months or so, I was at 4% in the polls. And I used to say, of the 4%, 3% thought I was my father.
So you grew up in New Jersey, and then you went to Williams College.
I went to Williams.
One of the, what they call the small, little Ivies?
Yeah, they call them the little three.
Yeah. My son went to Wesleyan. So
did he?
Yeah.
So it's Williams, Wesleyan, and Amherst.
Right.
So Wesleyan's a great school.
Yeah. So great is Williams. School.
So is Williams.
Fabulous places.
Absolutely.
And then what prompted you to go to law school? Because I ask myself that question all the time.
Well, I had always wanted to be a lawyer. And, I was really, sometimes you read a book or you take a course and it becomes kind of romantic almost. So for me, what I wanted to do was be like Clarence Darrow, who was a famous trial attorney, right? Just like you, right, Steve?
I am a trial attorney.
Yeah. So,
and mostly criminal defense. So
so there you go.
I read the book, read about Clarence Darrow, and I never grew up. I kept doing it.
Yeah. So that's what attracted me to it.
And then I saw that, I know that you went to work as a assistant United States attorney.
I did. So I was on the other side of the fence.
Sure. I know that.
You know, as you would know.
It's okay. You're forgiven.
Yeah. Well, I was attracted to, the notion of being on my feet. You know, I had debated in high school. You know, I've tried many things in my life. Some things I didn't do very well. Some things I did okay. And some of the things I did okay at, I never expected to be okay at it. You know, like, for example, I debate where I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. If you were on the debate team, you better be on a football team. Otherwise, you're going to get your butt kicked. And so I got pushed into debating by another friend of mine. And it turned out I did okay. I did pretty well. So I realized I enjoyed being on my feet. I enjoyed, the give and the take. And when I read that biography of Clarence Darrow in a history course at Williams in 73, 72, I went, wow, that's kind of cool. He's defending people accused, wrongly of a crime.
Yeah, like Perry Mason. All your clients are innocent.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wish that were always the case.
Well, I found out later that is not always the case.
So was working as a U.S. attorney the first job out of law school?
When you're an assistant U.S. attorney, the rule is you got to work somewhere for 2 years. You know, if you want to be an assistant district attorney, you can apply for that position out of law school. So I went to work for a law firm in New York City. It was a smaller firm that was a spinoff of a big firm. I thought I'd have a lot of time in court. And after about a year, I realized that was wrong. I was not going to court, and I was not likely to be going to court. So I applied for a job at the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York City, and I was fortunate enough to get the job.
Yeah. How long did you do that?
3 years.
They want a three-year commitment. At least they do nowadays.
Yeah, still did. Same thing.
And Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney
at the
time?
He was the U.S. attorney. And, I mean, if you talk about lucky things in your life, I've had a lot of luck. I mean, obviously, being born into my family, you know, being born with dad and mom, they're great blessings. And, you know, one of the other great blessings for me was going to work for Rudy Giuliani, who at that point was a very young guy. I think he was 38. And, you know, nobody knew what the future had in store. But Dad told me something about Rudy that he had heard. And, you know, I don't know if I can, I should be careful of things on, you know,
No one's listening. Say whatever you want.
He was colorful. Dad basically said that he had heard that Rudy was a real shit stirrer. And he said, in life, if you can, go to work for people that make things happen. And Dad was like that. I went to work for Dad later. But when I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, my very first case that Rudy gave me was prosecuting one of the leaders of one of the five crime families in New York, the Bonanno family. So you would know about them,
course.
Steve, Joe Bonanno's successor, Philip Rastelli. And, you know, Rudy was like, hey, we're going after everybody. We're going after the mafia. We're going after the drug, you know, lords. We're going after Wall Street. You know, we don't care. In fact, about 2 years into it, Rudy, one of his assistants had someone arrested on Wall Street because they were suspected of insider trading. It was my wife and my brother's boss. That was a little close for comfort.
Wow. Yeah,
I was glad. I was in organized crime at that point. That was safer for me than insider trading.
And somehow I sense that those 3 years under Giuliani, they blossomed because you later worked on his campaign.
Yeah, what happened was, this is kind of, if you fast forward, so I stopped working for Rudy in 1988, and I went to work with my brother and my dad. And I was kind of the lawyer in the family. As Dad used to say, you are the only lawyer in the family, and that is one too many. You'll like that, Steve, right?
I hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you hear that stuff all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
For the 12 years I worked with Dad until he passed away, I used to hear that all the time.
So you go back and you're working, in essence, with the family business, which is investments.
Exactly.
And not practicing law at all.
Well, since I was the only lawyer in the family, I was the general counsel of the family business.
Which means you get asked a lot of questions and you get no gratitude for it.
Oh, totally. You get asked a lot of questions. But one of the nice things I found is that, you know, there's no more lowly existence than a first-year lawyer, first-year associate at a law firm.
Right.
No tougher existence in my experience. Now I got to retain the firms that, you know, normally, you know, I'd be, you know, the snake on the path. Right. You know what I mean?
And so you're helping make decision. We're going to hire this firm and pay them a gazillion dollars, and that one another gazillion. And which of you wants to grovel enough to get the business from us?
You got it.
Right?
It was terrific. And so you asked about Rudy. So in 2000, you know, I was in touch with Rudy, as many people were that worked for him during the 90s when he was mayor of New York. You know, we were friendly, absolutely. But what really brought us close was I ran for governor in 2000. I ran for governor in the 2002 election cycle, but I started running in like 2000. And he agreed to help me because someone that was the mayor of New York, if you could get their endorsement when you're running for high office, that's a very good thing.
Fundraising and recognition.
Totally.
And
totally.
All that stuff.
And so one time in 2001, I was coming back to New York, and I called Rudy. I said, can you have breakfast with me? I'll be in New York doing some fundraising. He said, absolutely. And so we agreed to have breakfast on the morning of September the 11th, 2001. And literally, it was Rudy and me and a guy named Denny Young, who was his number two at the U.S. Attorney's Office. The three of us, we were about 45 minutes into breakfast when the phone rang, and Rudy took the phone call from one of his security people and was advised that a plane had hit the World Trade Center.
Where were you having breakfast?
At the Peninsula Hotel on 55th Street and Fifth Avenue. And, you know, that was kind of a moment in time for all of us.
Of course, we all remember.
And so people all the time ask Rudy, where were you when you got the call? And God bless him, he always says, I was with my dear friend Bill Simon running for governor of California. I mean, so you become, it kind of takes on a life of its own, if you know what I mean. Just that fortuitous, horribly fortuitous event. And, he starts out his book on leadership, you know, talking about that breakfast. You know, there's, anyway, over the years, a number of things have happened where Rudy and I were brought together by, you know, fate, whatever you want to call it. And we've become very close friends. And so when I ran for governor, I got very close, as you mentioned, Steve. And so I had a lot of credibility in the Republican Party as a young whippersnapper who got close. Dad would say, he wasn't alive at that point. I wish he had been alive during the campaign. You know, he might have said, you know, a tie is like kissing your sister. That's what he used to tell me. And so, you know, being runner-up, George Bush told me, President George W. Bush said to me, you know, there are no runner-up cups in politics. And that's true. However, there's a lot of credibility that you get when you run a campaign and you don't fall on your face. Now, I made plenty of mistakes, but coming out of it, you know, I got closer than almost anybody had in a very long time as a conservative Republican. So Rudy was happy to have me jump on his bandwagon in 08. You know, when he ran for president, he put me in charge of all policy because I'm kind of a closet academic. And he put me in charge of his speech writing and chair of the state of California, which is an important state when you're running for president. So, you know, we have been very close. I still see him. You know, I see him always at the September 11 dinners that we have in New York. And, I think the guy is, you know, probably the greatest public servant, maybe outside my dad, that I ever met. He's a truly great public servant.
Interesting. Brooke is letting me know that it's time for us to take our first break. So let's take a brief pause and we'll continue in a minute.
Awesome, Bill. Really. I just want to take care of some business. Shout out to my dear friend Trish Bowe and her State Farm agency. And hey, Trish, I'll get you that earthquake thing soon. And also to my buddy Anthony over at Amalfi. Keep selling, keep buying, keep making the Palisades beautiful. And let's see what else. I think that's about all we have. And then we'll come back. And I know Keith has a question. And I have a couple questions. And we'll take it from there. Sound good? All right. We'll be back in a sec.
We're going to pause. Okay. So, Bill, moving on from Rudy Giuliani, let's get back to your career. You're working with your dad and your brother. What was the name of that company?
William E. Simon and Sons.
Okay. And are you still working there?
You know, I am, except the company last month merged with another firm, Massey Quick. And so the name of the new firm is Massey Quick and Simon.
All right. But doing the same thing.
Doing the same thing, yeah.
Financial investing for private clients, for businesses, foundations.
Exactly.
Okay. And so that's basically been your career. As a other than a stint as a lawyer, you've been a financial investor.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, now, since I ran for governor in 02, I've I've had an opportunity to sit on the boards of some think tanks, you know, like Hoover and Heritage. So I played a role there, and I'm still active.
But not think tank for the Democratic Party.
No.
I'm joking. I know that.
Yeah, no, Hoover and Heritage are pretty much center
right. Right, I know that. Hoover's at Stanford. Right?
Hoover's at Stanford. Heritage is in Washington. Uh-huh. And then we have a couple of family foundations. We got the William E. Simon Foundation, which Dad set up. My brother and I co-chair, and my five sisters are trustees. And then my wife and I have set up a foundation, the Cynthia L. and William E. Simon Jr. Foundation, and we do a number of different things there. So I would say that my career now, honestly, Steve, is probably more philanthropy than it is investing.
That is just a perfect segue.
You know?
So,
and I teach. I love teaching.
You teach at UCLA Law School.
I do. And also UCLA undergrad.
And I teach at Pepperdine Law School. So I know the same joys of teaching.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. It's wonderful, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's nice being able to give back some of the lessons you've learned from all these years, the mistakes, the success stories. And
totally.
Teach them to the, as I say when I teach that class, it's I'm going to teach you the stuff that I never learned in law school.
What do you teach?
Trial practice.
Oh, perfect.
So that's what I know.
I teach rhetoric and advocacy.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we inject a little rhetoric and advocacy in my class too. Not probably as sophisticated as what you're doing. So that's a perfect segue. We've gotten through your family, your career. Let's now turn to some of your philanthropic and charitable work that you do, the foundations. We have somebody here from the Midnight Mission. I know you've been involved with that. So,
yeah, we love the Midnight Mission.
Tell us how your foundations work and the types of groups that you sponsor and what you do in the community.
Well, I would kind of separate it out into two different themes. You know, one is our family foundation that my dad founded, you know, is principally focused on a couple of geographic areas, Jersey City, Morristown, New Jersey, and Harlem in New York. We do a little bit out here, but not much. And, you know, the underlying programs that we like to support are faith-based programs. We're Catholics. School-based programs. We support both public and Catholic schools. And family activities that tend to strengthen families. And then I have a kind of a favorite pet project, which involves religious freedom. I'm a great believer in religious freedom. And so we have kind of fought those battles all over the country for, you know, about 15 years now. We have an institute we set up at Princeton in honor of my mother and dad in support of religious freedom. So it's kind of First Amendment style.
Religious freedom for all religions?
Absolutely.
Does that entail keeping government out of religion, separation of church and state?
Sure.
Those get into complicated issues.
Oh, they're very complex. And there are a lot of fact patterns that make it even more complex.
Right. There are some people that would be, without naming groups, certain religious groups will say that we think that the government should limit certain rights of individuals because they're not in keeping with that religious belief. Others view it differently, that they want the government to be involved in protecting their religious freedoms. And how do you make those decisions?
Well, a lot of times it's based on the facts. You know, I could say that, you know, for example, every Christmas time, there's lots of litigation about Christmas songs in schools, you know, crosses being publicly displayed. You know,
the creche in Santa Monica that was a subject of litigation for many years.
Totally. And, you know, I'm kind of an absolute believer that whatever the religious symbol is, it should be allowed to be displayed. And, you know, there's lots of people that disagree with me. And so we love debating that topic.
And one could take the opposite view that if you are putting religious symbols in public places, then the government is taking a stand in favor of that religion to the detriment of other religions or
totally.
Non-believers.
Totally. You know, I think that, you know, one way that's been summarized is, you know, there's a great book by Richard Neuhaus in the 80s called The Naked Public Square. So there's some people that believe there should be no religious objects on display. That'd be like the ACLU, mm-hmm. which I believe the ACLU actually stands for Anti-Christian Litigation Unit. And so there's some people that take that view, right? Then there's other people that say you should have a sacred public square. I'm not in that group. They're the ones that say there should be really only one state religion. And I believe that you should have a civil public square, not naked, not sacred, but civil. And civil means, you know, if they want to put a, if they own a piece of property, they should be allowed to put a cross on it.
They meaning who?
The owner.
What if the owner is the city of Los Angeles or Santa Monica or...
You know, there's room for debate on that one.
Right.
Can I ask Bill a question?
Of course.
Okay. Your book, Great Catholic Charities. Or
parishes.
Great Parishes. Sorry, Great Catholic Parishes.
There's a lot of great Catholic
yeah,
charities.
I know.
But I didn't write a book on those.
But you wrote a book called Great Catholic Parishes.
Ranking different parishes? Like
No, it well, was... We, it was well... It was really fascinating, and it was a lot about best practices. And from what I understand, Bill went out and interviewed or spoke with over 200 parishes about how they work together. And it was really interesting to see how these different congregations worked hand in hand to accomplish change. And my question to you as a supporter of the Midnight Mission, which I know you are, is do you ever see a world where the ability of parishes to work together could work with government to impact the homeless problem?
Yes.
And how would you see that playing out?
Well, I think it's being played out now. I think that, you know, take my parish is not far from here, St. Monica's in Santa Monica. Now, I love Corpus, too. You know, we live on the same street as Corpus Christi here in the Palisades. But I'm particularly close with the pastor at St. Monica's. And he has a lot of outreach activities to homeless in Santa Monica. There's a ton of homeless people in Santa Monica. So a really vibrant Catholic parish often has outreach efforts, you know, to homeless, as does Midnight Mission. And so, and then there's a whole group of parachurch organizations, you know, not parishes, but groups like Catholic Charities. You know, Catholic Charities has, you know, they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on homeless issues, you know, each and every year.
And they certainly must work hand in hand with the local police and the local fire department.
Totally. So, just like Midnight Mission.
Right. So it doesn't seem like there's so much of a need for the separation of church and state on a local level that
well, you know, I think that, you know, as I mentioned to Steve, and Steve is obviously very well versed, you know, in these areas as a lawyer and as a professor at Pepperdine, I think there's a lot of good that can be done, not just with homeless, but the various initiatives at Midnight Mission, to take an example, you know, the Women's Initiative, you know, many other initiatives. You know, there's so much good that can be done without even mentioning, you know, a religion. You know, you're just talking about, you know, getting people off the street, feeding them, clothing them, giving them shelter, maybe educating them down the road. In my case, I happen to stumble on a great Catholic parish at St. Monica's, you know, late in life. You know, I've been there now 27 years, but I'm 66, so I discovered it when I was 39. We moved out here from Jersey. So, you know, I think that Catholic parishes, in fact, evangelical parishes of any faith, you know, Jewish, you know, synagogues, are the single greatest engine for good in human history. Honest to God. And if you ever hear somebody like a Rick Warren from Saddleback Church talk, that's exactly what he's going to say. So it's not about separating church and state. So Rick Warren was brought to Rwanda, and when there was the genocide 10 years ago, and he was asked by the president of Rwanda, I'll introduce you anybody you want, Rick, you know, business people, politicians, you name it. And you know what he said? I want to meet the pastors. So why is that? Because according to Rick And I agree now, having studied Brooke, and I'm glad you read the book. He said that parishes are the greatest engine for good in human history. I mean, not an exaggeration. You look at schools, you look at hospitals, you look at all the things the Catholic Church has done, and now many other churches. And you'd have to say, you know, they've done a hell of a lot more good than any government anywhere. They've outlasted every single government since Rome when Christ died in 33 AD. So, you know, to me, the privilege of working.
I have to jump in. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but couldn't one also make the argument that religion has been the greatest source of misery and anguish for people? Going the Crusades, the jihads, the things like that, where people in the name of one religion who were convinced that their religion was the only good religion slaughtered millions of people over the years.
Totally. I'm not going to disagree with that.
So
I don't think that's in conflict or in contradiction, you know, with my statement that parishes, the local church.
The locals.
You know, I mean, you can't go anywhere in this world without seeing a local church.
And one time when I was a room mother at Marquez, I ran the career day.
Yeah.
And so I called all the clergy in the Palisades, every single one of them. And as people were checking in, I looked down Marquez Boulevard, and there comes the rabbi, the pastor, the priest, the guy from the Self-Realization Temple, all yakking with each other like they were, you know, best buddies. And I realized, that's how you get things done in this town. It's called them.
And totally.
Totally.
Like we, you know, there's been a lot of great pastors and ministers. And, you know, it almost doesn't matter what the faith is. And that's where I try to, as I get older now, for me, it's really become helping people one by one. That's what Midnight Mission does.
Speak one about, by one. About your Sound Body and Mind Foundation and how the program at the Midnight Mission that uses physical fitness for rehabilitation and Coach Val and that whole piece of the work that you do with them.
Well, I'm obviously passionate about, you know, my little pet projects, and please excuse me for being enthusiastic.
Passion is okay on our podcast. It's not forbidden.
About this, but, you know, so I'm passionate about, you know, Catholic parishes and really local churches of any kind. And I am super duper duper passionate about physical fitness. So I was an athlete in school. Not a great athlete like Division I football or anything, but I went to a Division III school and I was captain of two teams, All-American and one. And, you know, so I went to practice every day, you know, all seasons because of those sports. And I always knew that I felt better about myself when I got exercise. It wasn't until a lot later that I understood why that was scientifically. And many things in my life I've stumbled into. And some of the things, as I said at the start, have worked out and some haven't. You know, we could spend the whole show talking about mistakes that I've made. And we could do probably two or three shows on that.
Maybe four, five, six. Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
We go on and on.
Totally. And
as opposed to us who've never made any.
Well, but we have a neighbor here. Jake Steinfeld is his name. And he was the mayor of the Palisades and good guy. And, you know, he asked me if my wife, Cindy, I might like to put in a fitness center at Pali High. That was in 98. And we agreed. And sometimes you don't know where things are going to lead. And sometimes you make a gift and that's the end of it. Sometimes you make a gift and it didn't do what you thought it was going to do. Sometimes you make a gift and you realize there's something else there. Well, we heard from St. Monica's. We heard from Santa Monica High School, SAMO. We heard from Venice. Hey, we heard what you did up at Pali. What about us? So before I knew it, you know, we had financed physical fitness centers at, you know, five or six high schools, kind of local high schools. And we realized that there was a demand for it. There was a demand for it because there was no money for PE in school. Every time you had to cut back on something in school, mm-hmm. they cut back arts, music, PE. And so they loved us. And even though I'm a conservative Republican and unions are running the schools, you know, they didn't have any problem with me as long as I was showing up with something that they needed. And that was physical fitness equipment.
And how does it work in the Midnight Mission when you're not dealing with healthy young students? You're dealing with people that have really wreaked havoc on their bodies.
Well, we don't actually do anything at Midnight Mission, you know, in our Sound by Sound Mind program. We've given them money for it. But what we have focused on are really schools. And so we actually haven't gone into any other types of institutions. You easily could. And I'm familiar with what they do at the Midnight Mission vis-a-vis physical activities. But I have to be honest with you and say we did not finance that.
Right, but you support it.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Because I think, you know, once again, I'll make a bold statement, right? Parishes are the greatest engine for good in human history. Well, physical fitness is more important than math and English and science. More important, not as important. And it's treated now in schools all across the country as the ugly stepchild. Mm-hmm. You know, first place to get a cut. You know, it's a babysitting service when there is, you know, PE. And it's just treated very badly. So as an example, in LAUSD, they spend on average, you know, about $12,000-$13,000 a child. You know, that attracts state funding and local funding. Of that $12,000 to $13,000, $50 is spent on PE. $50 per student. So you can't do anything with $50.
You just normally see kids running around the track.
Yeah.
That's about all they whenever right. you drive by.
If they
school,
if they have a track.
Or they run around something. You see kids just running around. You don't see yeah. them lifting weights. You don't see them doing
totally.
Anything other than that.
Now, this goes back thousands of years that physical fitness should be part of education. The Greeks, the Romans, you know, Greeks invented the Olympics. It's beyond argument that we feel better about ourselves. Research has shown your grades are higher. Research has shown that your brain grows, not shrinks, when you get physical exercise. You know, it leads to a longer life in most instances. You know, why the educational establishment would ignore something that would help their students, their clients, get educated. So we've been doing this. Next year will be our 20th anniversary. So we've gone from 5 schools in the first 6 months or so. We're now in 130 schools. We impact over 160,000 kids every year. We've measured. We have a curriculum. We have a training program. And it was all because we just put one foot in front of the other. We had no idea we'd end up here.
And now you're part of UCLA?
Now we got part of UCLA. What happened was, see, there's another case where serendipity. You know, my dad used to, he was a big influence on my life. And Dad would always say, you know, just look at what's trying to happen. Just look at what's in front of you. And if you're getting a lot of fight about it, then just do something else where the wind is at your back. So I was chair of the board. I am chair of the board of UCLA Hospital. And, you know, UCLA, rightfully so, touts their engagement with the community. They got a lot of programs that they engage with the community. Venice Family Clinic, you know, you name it. UCLA is very frequently involved.
And it's also a public university, so it has an obligation to give back.
Totally.
Think, more than a private school who can, they can do what they want.
Absolutely. So I, as chair of the board, you know, obviously I had a lot of interaction with the CEO, who's on the board, at that point was on the board of Sound Body, Sound Mind. The name of our foundation is Sound Body, Sound Mind. You got a sound body, you're going to have a sound mind. And I said to the CEO, you know, I hear everybody touting this community engagement. Why don't you take over Sound Body, Sound Mind? Just take it over. Make it be UCLA Health Sound Body, Sound Mind. I promise you I'll still run it. I'll make our staff the same right out of our offices. I'll keep a real eye on it, real close eye on it, and we'll just grow this baby. Because right now, if we became part of UCLA, we'd be the largest community engagement program tomorrow morning, the day after we closed the deal. And the CEO said, sounds good.
When was that?
2 years ago.
How's it going?
Fabulous. So we're up to 130 schools. we're going to have our 20th anniversary next October 25th. I invite everybody in your audience, all of you, October 25th, the Luskin Center at UCLA. We're going to have a hell of a celebration. And you know what we're going to celebrate, amongst other things? We will have reached 150 schools by that point.
And give me an idea, and for those that don't know, what do you do when you pick a school, and give us an idea what you do at that school?
Well, we have a good relationship with LAUSD, so they will surface some schools. But now, after 19 years, you know, they know about us in the schools, so they apply. So every year, we're running at a rate of about 12 new schools a year. And last year, we had 35 applicants. This year, the application process opens up in 2 weeks. And so when the applicants come in, we interview them, and we select 12. And then more often than not, we'll tell the schools we didn't admit, come back next year. Here's the following things that you should try to get done, and don't worry. Come back next year. After the interview, we go to the site. We get it ready. One of the conditions is that they paint the room and make sure the room is in good shape. We arrange for the equipment to be delivered, and we have a curriculum training. We train the PE teachers, and we have our curriculum that they use. Then we have a big, bad ribbon cutting in the spring. Like this year, we had, I think, 12 ribbon cuttings. And St. John's Hospital, which I want to put a plug in for them, they financed 3 schools in Santa Monica because that's their footprint, right? So we go to places where people will say, wow, we'd love to have you here, and or we'd love to be supportive. And UCLA has been great. They've got an infrastructure that is incredible, you know.
What kind of equipment?
You know, it depends on the school. So our first 50 schools was pretty much all high schools. Then when we hit 50, we had a big gala, and we said we're going to go into middle schools. So now we're into middle schools and high schools. We're not in grammar schools. So we're in middle schools 6, 7, 8, high schools, 9 through 12.
And what do you have? Like,
is it like weightlifting?
Elliptical machines,
treadmills? We've got cardio and strength. So for high school, you can do the traditional stuff. You know, you can do barbells, you can do, treadmills, ellipticals, weight machines, that type of thing.
So you don't need to build a stadium. You don't need to build a track. You just need...
You need 1,500 square feet. That's it. You got 21
awesome.
Stations. We have 21 stations, with different pieces of equipment. Middle school is different. So we've got what they call sandbells. Because if young kids drop a barbell, a free weight on their toe, they're going to break their toe. So what we do is... We have these sandbells where there's sand in it, and if they drop that on their toe, no problem. And then we have in the younger kids, we got spin bikes, and we got agility things, that you might have run into.
And so, do you have some arrangement with various companies provide it at a discount?
Oh yeah.
And you go into a place and you'll say, this is a room that's whatever the size is, and we're going to put 3 ellipticals, 1 treadmill, a set of weights, and you kind of have a formula for what you're going to do in these places?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you're not,
at this point, it's kind of a cookie cutter.
Right. You're not reinventing the wheel every time you go into a new school.
No.
You tell them what you're going to give them and what instruction the teachers need in order to help the students be proficient with them.
The only exception, and here I can get a little... choked up. There's 13 special needs schools in LAUSD. And there you need really special equipment. You need treadmills that can go in pools because some kids, can only work out in a pool. Those are heart grabbers. So we're in all 13 special needs schools in town. And at Christmas time, speaking about religious freedom, we get dressed up as Santa, and we go to these special needs schools and hand out gifts. And if you want to go someplace,
we would like to go.
And, we'll make it happen. We'll make it happen. We're going to pick.
That'd be great.
A very special needs school. It's an incredible population of kids that didn't do anything to deserve the situation that they're in. So we bring them presents. We bring them, we bring them joy. We bring them hope. And there's not a dry eye in the house. guarantee.
So it sounds to me like your life now, although you still have your business, is more focused on your charitable giving and your philanthropic activities.
Yeah, I like the one-on-one approach, you know, honestly. You know, we have staff, we have a great staff at Sound by Sound Mind, you know, with this the parish project, which we call Parish Catalyst. You know, they have a staff. They do all the important work. I get all the credit. They do all the work. I get the credit. And
you also have to write the checks.
You know, I got to write the checks. That's true. But we raise money as well. But I guess I would tell you a story that, you know, because I want to make sure to highlight Midnight Mission. They are an incredible, incredible organization. And I was introduced to them, you know, by a friend of mine, oh, probably 15, actually it's now it's more, it's 20 years ago. And his name is Clancy Immisland, and he's an incredible guy. And Clancy didn't know this, but he said, I want you to come down to Midnight Mission and meet some of the people that help us. And I went down, and there was Dick Van Dyke. And I went, oh, my God. I mean, I grew up with this guy, right? You know,
yeah.
Mary Poppins, you know, Dick Van Dyke show. I walked around Midnight Mission with Dick Van Dyke. I was like, I'm going to support this place. You know, I know that's probably the wrong motive in the beginning. But then, little by little, I saw what work they did. And one year, every year at Christmas time, we generally go skiing if we can. And my kids were teenagers at that point, and that year, I thought that they were, not behaving themselves, so to speak. I mean, I know probably all your kids have been perfect, but and we love our kids, right? We love them. So I said, guys, the skiing vacation is canceled. We're going to Midnight Mission every day and feed the people, and that's what we did, right out of that blue. And you know, that gave me another window on the important work of Midnight Mission. And I try to go to their gala every year. You know, one year I think they honored David Feinberg, who was, you know, CEO at UCLA. And, you know, it's just been an incredible, incredible group. And, you know, no matter how little money you give them, they put it to good use.
Oh, speaking of, I want to plug for my friend David Prentice down at the Midnight Mission.
Yeah, sure.
If it costs, David tells me it costs 95 cents for a meal at Midnight Mission to feed one person. So if you guys want to give, just text meals 71777 and just do however much you want, but it's interesting and easy to just think a buck a meal. Meals 71777, and we'll put that on our show notes. Also, I wanted to ask you, the Midnight Mission has a program called the Healthy Living Program, the 11 apartments that is a transitional situation for families, taking them from homelessness to independence, financial, not relying on income from the state, the feds, the city. There are 11 apartments. It's been remarkably successful. How would you, as a financial guru, scale that?
You know, the folks at Midnight Mission know better than me, Brooke. So I think you'd have to, you know, study it to see, you know, how would you best scale it? To me, it's definitely scalable. In other words, if it could work with 11, maybe add another 10. See how that goes.
The stat that I read was that it costs for a family between $49,000 and $169,000 per year, which, you know, if you're making $169,000 a year, you don't need free housing. And it just somehow seems like if that money's there for that, then couldn't we somehow put it into construction or I don't know.
Yeah,
but
no,
I think high rate of success they're having.
You know, I think that, you know, David Prentice, would know very well in terms of scaling it. I would say that our approach to philanthropy, which was really started by, you know, my mother and dad, honestly, and I've continued it. So has my brother and my five sisters in our way, in our communities. But they always had, especially dad, you know, who really grew up with nothing and ended up, you know, being very successful. he's willing to give anything a try, right? So is it scalable? Dad used to say, don't be guilty of analysis paralysis. Mm. So, you know, let's just, you know, just go do it, you know, and see. Because there's all kinds of things that we have done that, you know, never see the light of day. But you know you're helping people. So to me, to go from 11 to 15 or 20, don't check with me. Just do it, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, you know, when we scaled Soundbody, Soundminer, we scaled Parish Catalyst, you're going to hit some bumps in the path. But once again, philanthropy, everybody's got a different view. The Simon family view, not just me, but my whole family, is one at a time. Let's just get it done. Let's not ask a lot of questions. You ask if the government's involved. Makes me nervous when the government's involved because that means paperwork, right?
Right.
So I'll tell you a story that's kind of, you know, in any family, there's always folklore, right? There's always family folklore. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. But anyway, my mom died at a very young age. She died when she was 64. She had cancer when she was 46. And so it came back 18 years later. And during those 18 years, unbeknownst to anybody, including her husband, my father, and any of us, every day she sent flowers to the floor at the hospital locally where the terminally ill patients were dying from breast cancer or another form of cancer. So I hope I can get through this story. So anyway, so my mom's now on that floor in her final days, literally. And in the room are a bunch of flowers. And the nurse comes in and says, I finally know who was that angel all these years, because it was no flower of that type. And what my mother used to do is on that card that she would sign herself, she would say, from someone who loves you. So the person that was dying had no idea. Maybe it was their husband. Maybe it was one of their children. And when the nurse said, I now know who the angel is, my mother winked at the nurse. And the only way that we knew that story was because the nurse told my father. And that to me is the essence of the philanthropy that we have done. So when you go down to midnight, I remember, you know, back when I was, you know, active in politics, I called Clancy Immisland, you know, the head of Midnight Mission at that time. And I was going to go on a radio show like this. And a lot of times in those days, I was busy. I'm not as busy anymore. And I was busy and I would, you know, I knew I'd be asked questions and I'd get a little bit quick sound bites, you know, so I would sound intelligent, you know. So I call Clancy, who by that point was a friend. I say, hey, Clancy, I'm going to be interviewed on KSFO or whatever the radio station was. And they want to talk to me about homelessness. Can you give me, you know, just what causes homelessness? What's up? He said, Bill, I've been working at Midnight Mission 35 years. I have no idea what causes homelessness. All I know is we help people one at a time. We're not looking for causes. We're looking to help.
Are you familiar with the homeless task force in the Palisades?
Oh, yeah. My wife is very active.
Because one of our previous guests, Mariam Czar, is the person that started it and is still involved with it. But it's been a pretty remarkable story of
totally.
What they've done in the Palisades.
Totally.
They haven't eliminated it.
No, but they're making progress.
Made a lot of progress. And it's just people saying, I can make a difference. Let's do something.
No, I mean, there's a whole group. My wife, we live about a quarter mile from here, and my wife has a lot of buddies in the hood. And, you know, they've all gotten active with the task force. And, you know, there's two groups. There's OPCC and LAMP, and they've now merged. Mm-hmm. And so we all support that merge, and they help too. You know, the task force works with, you know, the formerly the OPCC, and Charlie Smith and Stephen Jones and, you know, St. John's Hospital, you know, that supported Sound Body, Sound Mind, also supports, you know, the homeless activities.
So, all right. Keith, no questions? Okay. Well, I think this brings us to the end of the hour. I think we could go on for a couple more hours if we had the time, but we have to give back the office to Nick
Ranchin, general manager of Wells Fargo Bank. Thank you, Wells Fargo Bank, for letting us use your general manager's office as our studio. We really appreciate it.
Bill Simon, this has been a really fascinating hour for me, and I know for Brooke and for our listeners, and we appreciate you sharing your career, your life, your faith with us, and I think it will inspire anybody that hears about it.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you, Brooke. And go Midnight Mission.
Midnight Mission, text meals 71777, 95 cents for one meal. Come on, guys, give it up. Share the wealth.
Thanks a lot, Bill Simon.
Thank you, Steve.
We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy vanilla Visa gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank, MetaBank, and Sutton Bank, members FDIC, pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc., and may be used in the U.S. everywhere Visa debit cards are accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services. NMLS ID number 912772.